Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Gretchen Pasentino joins us here for the first 30 minutes or so. She is co-founder of Answers in Action, based in Costa Mesa, California, and news editor for the Christian Research Journal. We're going to deal with some of the stories that appear in the latest Christian Research Journal, a review of 2003 religion stories, beginning with the biggest, I think, and that is the consecration of Gene Robinson as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. We'll go on to talk about cults in Russia, an update on the Pensacola revival, and the death of Kenneth Hagin Sr. that happened late in the year as well. All that with Gretchen Pasentino here in the first 20 minutes of this second hour of Issues Etc. Wesley Smith will be our guest for the second half of this hour. We'll get an update on Terry Schindler's Shivo, euthanasia in Europe, and new stem cell research, a law in New Jersey. And I noticed in the LA Times today, well, actually, this is from the weekend, Howard Dean was criticizing President George W. Bush on the issue of stem cell research and the ban that he issued early in his tenure as president. We'll get Wesley's reaction to that as well. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, coming to you live this Wednesday, January the 14th. Gretchen, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd. It's good to be with you.
Gretchen, I do note there that right at the opening of the Christian Research Journal, there's a very touching remembrance of Bob from Elliot Miller, the editor.
There is. It was a great article, and I especially appreciated the funny story he put in from my son Paul about, he says Bob was a first-class character, and he talks about one time Kirby vacuum cleaner salesman came to the door and asked if we had any spots on our carpet, and by the time he and Bob and Paul got done, a couple hours later, our whole house was clean.
A bit of a salesman, too?
Bob could make deals like nobody I know. And the thing is, what was really interesting is that he could go get deals. He didn't pay retail at Sears. And I always scratch my head even now because as a Christian, he was completely honest and he never, ever, ever used deceit or anything like that to get his way. But somehow he just did.
So he didn't have to give up being a Sicilian when he became a Christian.
Well, I don't know. I suppose that there are Sicilians who would disagree with that, who would think that maybe, his strong Christian commitment somehow a little bit out of the loop. But I know this, that, whether it's Bob or me or you or other people who are leaders in the body of Christ, we really have to be careful that the way we act and what we say and how we behave really does reflect where our heart is. And I was glad that when Elliot Miller got a story from our son, it was a story of behind the scenes, and yet it was still a story that didn't bring shame to the gospel. So that's a good thing.
That's very good. Let's talk about some of the news stories from 2003 affecting religion and that have probably been much in the minds of our listeners and of Christians in general, beginning with the biggest religion story from 2003. The consecration of an openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. Run us through the entire story from beginning to end, and then I want to talk a little bit about its implications as well.
Well, I can't really run it through from beginning to end because we haven't seen the end yet, but I could state it in a very simple way and then a little more kind of looking at the progress. In a very simple way, what happened was last fall, the Episcopal Church in the United States agreed to the consecration of a bishop for New Hampshire who was a practicing homosexual who has, he's a male and he has a male life partner whom he lives with. And that was approved by the United States bishops as a whole, although there were dissenters when the vote was taken, it still passed. And so we can have that one event, the consecration of that bishop, that practicing homosexual bishop, as kind of the watershed event of the Episcopal Church in the United States last year. But really there's a lot going before that, a lot going after it. It's fascinating to me that on almost a daily basis we're seeing a change in one of the oldest and one of the largest Protestant denominations in the whole Christian world. The Episcopal Church is part of the wider communion or fellowship of churches called the Anglican Communion, with its headquarters in Canterbury in England. The Church of England is part of this Anglican Communion. And over the last almost 100 years, there have been a lot of changes going on in that communion. It began as a rebellion against the authority of the Pope in the time of King Henry VIII. Henry VIII did not receive permission from the Pope to divorce one of his wives. He was looking for a male heir and needed a new wife who could produce that for him. And so he just said, well, the Pope's not going to be the head of the church here in England anymore. And instead, the king became the head of the church, and the Archbishop of Canterbury became the head underneath the king. So really, by title, the Queen of England today is the head of the Church of England, although administratively and spiritually, the Archbishop of Canterbury is. Now, branches of that church have spread around the world. Till today, more than half of the Anglicans worldwide are actually in Africa, even though the Anglican Church in England has the largest number of Anglican members, 90% of them are non-practicing. England has become a very secular culture, and most people don't attend church. Well, what we've found over the last nearly 100 years is that church, which had its roots in the Reformation, which in many ways was very conservative and very tied to the historical, traditional, creedal foundation of Christianity, has become more and more liberal, embracing the higher criticism of the 19th century that denigrated the authority and the truthfulness and the reliability of the Bible, embracing the social gospel of the early 20th century, the idea that Christianity has no relevance if it cannot fit itself into the social Darwinianism that became popular in the early 20th century. And then in the last 50 years, with all of the different social and ethical revolutions in Western culture, especially those having to do with human sexuality and with roles, male and female gender roles in society and church and in the family. So that today we find an Episcopal church or an Anglican communion, worldwide Anglican communion, that ranges all the way from some of the very most conservative, evangelical, tradition-oriented, creedally confessing churches of some of the African and Indonesian communions to some of the very, very liberal congregations in the United States and Canada and Australia, and even in England, where there are some priests like Bishop Spong, who is an Anglican bishop who denies the deity of Christ, the resurrection, the bodily resurrection, the virgin birth, and yet he says in some sense Jesus was the divine way shower for us. And you have congregations where practicing lesbian pastors are bringing Wiccan and neo-pagan practices into their services as ways of updating their worship. So you go all the way from the very conservative to the very, very liberal, and many American Anglicans are kind of at a loss what to do.
Now, it sounds as though you're saying that had one been watching intently various movements within worldwide Anglicanism and the tendencies of American Anglicanism, that is, the Episcopal Church USA predominantly, what happened November 2nd this year with the consecration of Gene Robinson as the first openly gay bishop probably should not have come as any great surprise.
Well, as a matter of fact, earlier in the same summer of 2003, Archbishop Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury, had actually appointed as a bishop in England a priest named Geoffrey John, Canon Geoffrey John, a homosexual in a long-standing relationship, although he said it was physically celibate or sexually celibate. He had actually appointed him to be an acting bishop in the Diocese of Reading in England. That caused so much consternation and so much division in the Church of England that after a very short period of time, Canon John actually withdrew his name from consideration and said that he did not want his appointment to be something that would divide the Church of England. That was kind of a test case, and it was very interesting that that Williams, Archbishop Williams, seemed to be behind John removing his name from consideration. He was glad that there did not have to be an open confrontation and an actual division among members of the Church of England. Well, when it came to the fall and first the appointment of Gene Robinson and then his when the vote was approved at the Convention of the American Bishops and then his consecration actually took place in the fall, that caused an absolute break among many of the Anglican churches, not only in the United States but actually worldwide. There are many churches in the United States today, Anglican churches, who have not recognized that consecration, who have separated themselves from those congregations that approved it and who are seeking some sort of a relationship with worldwide Anglicanism that will not involve their relationship with what they see as the unbiblically liberal side of American Anglicanism.
Can you describe in some way from your research of this as a news story how these two opposing viewpoints that would be represented by, say, the outrage of much of the Southern Hemisphere Anglicans at the consecration of the bishop in New Hampshire, whereas, on the other hand, the jubilation of those who support his consecration, how these two viewpoints coexist in one massive church?
Well, I think the very simple answer would be it has coexisted because it has been informal, and no one has been forced to subscribe to either side. The more complex answer is that as the Anglican Communion worldwide has embraced form and practice more than content and doctrine, they have become less able to discern what is biblical and what is unbiblical, what is true and what is false, what is good and what is bad, so that you end up with a church where one Anglican official can say a statement we have in the journal, this is a church which has finally understood that men and women are created in the vision of God, that men and women created in the vision of God can be the guardians of the faith and be gay or lesbian. And in the same church, you have another Anglican leader saying, this is the most serious crisis Anglicanism has faced since its founding. The Episcopal Church USA is now formally heretical in its teaching about the family. You have both of those absolutely contradictory perspectives in the same communion because they don't have a common understanding of what is the final standard of truth. That is the Word of God, and that's what the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Communion worldwide, has failed to stand for over time.
I've even noted very briefly, Gretchen, in your response, of course, that Frank Griswold, who's the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, seems to have voted with the 38 primates against, warning against the consecration of Gene Robinson, and then barely 2 weeks later carried out the consecration.
Well, it's interesting that a lot of the people involved in the leadership in the worldwide Anglican Communion see a tension between their private beliefs and their public responsibility. The Archbishop himself, Archbishop Williams, has said that privately and personally, he sees no problem with sex outside of marriage. But as the Archbishop of Canterbury, he will support the church's stand that sex outside of marriage is wrong. That kind of double-mindedness, James talks about in James chapter 1, makes us unstable and not qualified for leadership.
Now let's go through some of these other stories as time permits here. First of all, John Kilpatrick, and I was trying to track this story down. This was a hard one to find myself. But John Kilpatrick, who was a revival leader in the Pensacola movement, has resigned. Tell us the story.
Yeah, actually, he resigned toward the end of 2003 to found his own ministry. He says that he used to be a pastor to the church, but now God has called him to be a pastor to pastors. And so, although he believes he's still called by God and still called by God to be in public ministry, that is to be a ministry to those who minister to others. He still stands behind all of the controversial practices and teachings of the Pensacola Revival, including the idea that the true indication of being indwelt or filled by the Holy Spirit is bizarre physical manifestations like barking and shaking and jerking and falling to the ground. And that sort of activity really characterizes the coming of the Spirit with power into the church. Now he's going to be focusing entirely on training other pastors to hold those same views.
Is this just a change of venue, or does it show any change in direction for Kilpatrick himself as kind of a general leader of quote-unquote revival in America?
I think that he is not changing any of his teachings or practices. I think that he found, as anyone would, that it is physically impossible to be so involved on an almost nightly basis, six nights a week, the church was open, in encouraging and participating in the extreme forms of physical and emotional expression that characterized the Pensacola Revival. Nobody can keep that up over a long period of time. I think he's conserving his energy and seeking to multiply his own unique and what I believe are unbiblical views in a much more efficient way by training the pastors who can then go back and minister to their congregations these strange ideas rather than ministering directly to the individuals.
And he seems to be following in the footsteps of Steve Hill, Michael Brown, and Lyndall Cooley as well, who all have left that church to found their own ministries.
Yes, they have. In fact, all of those ministries are also characterized by the same kinds of things that we saw with the Pensacola Revival, although on a smaller scale and with somewhat less intensity. The Toronto Blessing also has just had its 10-year reunion conference. And although that's not in the news update article for this journal issue, it's something that just happened actually over the last week. And visitors who go there will still see the same kinds of activities, the same kinds of expressions, but the numbers have greatly decreased, and the numbers of people who come back night after night after night has greatly decreased. It's a kind of intensity that not only do I believe it's unbiblical, but it's actually spiritually and emotionally unhealthy to keep up over time.
Before we move on to the subject of cults in Russia, let's talk with Ty, who's on the phone, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Ty, welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, thank you. How are you doing, Todd?
Very well.
And Gretchen, I just want to say I'm sorry for your loss and for Heaven's gain. And I really miss Bob. I mean, if you could follow him, the amount of information he could shoehorn into about 20 seconds was just mind-blowing, and I just really miss him. He was fantastic.
Well, thank you very much, and I just encourage you to take a look at our website. You can reach it through the Issues Etc. website. And the whole right-hand column of our homepage is dedicated to some classic Bob articles and issues. And there people also can leave their favorite Bob stories. And I know many of us, you know, not just me as his wife, but also as an Answers in Action leader, our board of directors and our staff, we love going to that site over and over again and looking at the different stories that people have of the ways that God impacted them through Bob's ministry.
Ty, you had a question there?
Yes, I do. I just wanted to point out that I'm not a scholar by any means when it comes to the Episcopal Church, but it seems to me I've read a few books on the extremely controversial bishop, Bishop Pike, back in the 60s, and it seems to me a lot of what is going down today in the Episcopal Church, it was able to happen because of what happened with Pike, because of an attempt to censor this incredibly controversial figure back in the 60s. It caused so much controversy that the Episcopal Church had basically removed any sort of apparatus they had within themselves to censor anyone in order to avoid this sort of controversy in the future. So now the Episcopal Church really has nothing in place to really censor anyone, even if they chose to. They pretty much... go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right, Ty. In the interest of time, we'll see. Let's get Gretchen's answer to your comment there. First of all, give us a brief bio, if you would, of Bishop Pike, and would you agree with Ty that this really was the time in which they neutered themselves against any defense for false teaching?
Well, I think I probably would say that rather than it being the cause of the lack of power in the Anglican Church for biblical standards, it was more an evidence of that lack of power and lack of commitment to biblical standards. Bishop Pike was very, very controversial. He wrote a number of books in which he questioned the deity of Christ. He questioned the need for conversion to Christ. He questioned the authority of the Scripture in all areas. He questioned practically every essential creedal or confessional belief of Christianity. In addition to that, he was very deeply affected by the death of his son. His son as a young adult died, and he spent many years looking for evidence of life after death by going to psychics and participating in seances and using other kinds of occultic means to try to receive some sort of comfort after the death of his son. It is true that the Episcopal Church was not effective in countering the aberrant teachings that Bishop Pike, and actually there were other people who were less well-known who were doing that too. But I think it's primarily because the Episcopal Church, or the worldwide Anglican Communion, has only four basic established points of unity. The Bible as the ultimate standard of faith. That doesn't mean it always tells the truth. That doesn't mean it's always right. That doesn't mean everything it says is infallible. Second, the Apostles and Nicene Creeds, although those are open to interpretation, I'll never forget one time Bob was talking with someone who was in a similar, he wasn't Anglican, but a very similar kind of church, and Bob said, how can you celebrate the service and recite the Apostles' Creed when you don't believe Jesus was God? And he said, well, when I'm offering the service, I'm doing it in my role as a priest. When I'm by myself, I have my own opinion. Kind of like Dr. Williams saying, I personally don't believe it's wrong for people to have sex outside of wedlock, but as the Archbishop of Canterbury, I'll support it. And then the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper and the apostolic roots going back to the ordination, the ordination of their bishops, tracing it all the way back to the apostles. If you don't have the faith of the apostles, it doesn't matter if you have the laying on of hands of the apostles or the apostles' descendants. And without that solid, firm conviction of the truthfulness of God's Word, all of God's Word in all areas, it was very, very difficult for them to take a stand in the early 1900s with biblical criticism, in the later times with the social gospel, even later with issues of women's ordination, and then with the issues of sexual orientation and sexual practices. All of those things, including the issues with Bishop Pike, are a result of their abandonment of their obedience to the Word of God.
Gretchen, can you stick with us a few minutes after the bottom of the
Sure.
hour break here? We've got about 2 minutes before we go to this break. Let's talk about cults in Russia. What are we looking at here in terms of the demographics of religious beliefs in the former Soviet Union and Russia in particular?
Well, it's very interesting. When I was doing research for this article, I interviewed, although I didn't use it for the article, I interviewed a good friend of ours, George Bryson, who runs the Calvary Chapel Church Planting Mission in Russia, and he spends 2 weeks every month in Russia working with small community, almost house churches that are being started there. And in some senses, the Russian Orthodox Church is doing a good job in trying to keep people aware of what new churches in Russia are preaching the gospel and what new churches in Russia are very, very aberrant, such as the Mormons teaching that there are many gods and you can become a god, or the Jehovah's Witnesses teaching that Jesus Christ is the first and mightiest creation of Jehovah God. But in other ways, the Russian Orthodox Church is so tied into the bureaucracy of the Russian government that they're also very antagonistic to small house churches and groups of Christians who want the purity of the gospel without the bureaucratic layers and without the many centuries of what to them seems to be dead tradition.
So we have, to say the very least, an extremely diverse religious community in Russia today, including many aberrant groups, at least as compared with the Russian Orthodox Church?
Yes, there are many groups, ones that most of us here are familiar with, the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Unification Church, Scientology, and others actually began in Russia, and they're unique to Russia. There are some kind of importations and modifications of Buddhism and Hinduism that are becoming very popular among some of the intellectual elite in Russia. And those provide opportunities for Christians to say, you know, you can have a sound faith, you can have good reasons for your faith, and you don't have to go into some sort of a mindless subjective experience such as in Hinduism or Buddhism.
Gretchen Pasentino is our guest. When we come back, she mentions Hinduism. Let's talk a bit about those who are converting out of Hinduism in India and what the Indian government and others in India are doing about it. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Why, O Lord, have you rejected me? Why do you hide your face from me? These words from Psalm 88 and other psalms like it can be deeply troubling to Christians. Not only do these psalms portray God as distant and indifferent, but they also sound a clear note of complaint. How should we understand these complaint psalms? Our first Issues Etc. book of the month for 2004 is called When God Becomes My Enemy, The Theology of the Complaint Psalms. For more information about this book, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. book of the month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy. Or, to order the book, call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc., 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Committees of the World Council of Churches are meeting in New York City to blast the United States. The liberal congregations don't like a host of administration policies. Keith Peters tells us what's bugging the group.
The United States is targeted for the group's so-called Decade to Overcome Violence. They accuse the U.S. of disregarding international order, refusing to be accountable to the United Nations, and ignoring the concerns of the world's populations. And there's more. Mark Tooley of the Institute on Religion and Democracy.
Looking at the lack of gun control, the practice of capital punishment, and even the U.S.'s domestic economic policies, which you're going to try to claim are examples of violence.
Craig Kibler of the Presbyterian Lay Committee isn't surprised by all of this.
It's a continuation of the Western bashing that WCC has been engaged in for many, many years now.
Mark Tooley says the people in the pews need to sit up and take notice of the WCC's rhetoric.
So I think local church members need to find out whether they are involved in the World Council, how much money is going from their church to the World Council, and start raising questions with their pastor or clergy person and the leadership in their church as to whether or not that funding should continue.
Over 30 denominations in the United States belong to the WCC, including almost all of the mainline Protestant groups, the traditional black denominations, and the Eastern Orthodox communions. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters.
The World Council of Churches has long been known for its leftist positions and is no stranger to attacking conservative policy. But it tends to turn a blind eye to atrocities in its own ideological camp. In its 50-year history, the group has ignored the crimes and oppressions of communist and Islamic dictatorships, many of them infamous for persecuting Christians. The World Council of Churches did not respond to our calls for comment. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Greg Stebbin, who's the author of 10 books, including Internet Privacy for Dummies. He's Best Buy's tech guy, and he's going to help us learn to use the high-tech gifts we may have gotten for Christmas this year. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Is it a sin to complain to God? Find out with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $19.99 plus shipping and handling. When God Becomes My Enemy, an in-depth study of the Complaint Psalms, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy, issuesetc.org.
A few more minutes here with Gretchen Passantino, rounding up some of the news from 2003 and late 2003 on the religious front, and then we'll be talking with Wesley Smith for the remainder of this hour about, well, another update. Terry Schindler-Schiavo, how are things going there in that case and with her? We'll talk about euthanasia in Europe and new stem cell research. A law has been passed permitting this, signed by the governor of New Jersey. We'll find out what that story is all about from Wesley Smith, rounding out this hour when we've concluded our conversation with Gretchen Passantino, co-founder of Answers in Action, based in Costa Mesa, California, and news editor for the Christian Research Journal. Gretchen, let's talk about one of the stories that appeared in the Christian Research Journal about the response within India to many from, I take it to be the lower castes, converting out of Hinduism. Tell us the story.
Well, the two main things I'd like to get out about this story is that, first of all, the idea that all 250 million of the casteless or untouchable or Dalit Indians in India are not converting to Christianity en masse. That's an urban legend. It's been making the rounds of the Internet for a couple of years. That's not really true. The story goes that they are so disillusioned with their status in Indian society under a Hindu majority that they are converting en masse to Christianity. But what is true, that because they are the lowest members of society, because they are denigrated in so many ways and have so little advantage to improve their state and life, they are very disgruntled with their Hindu heritage, and many of them are much more open to evangelism. But it's not just evangelism to Christianity. Many are turning to Buddhism. Many are becoming secularists. In fact, secularism is one of the fastest growing movements in India today among these untouchables, or the Dalits, as they're formally known. In a way, we see this as a great opportunity for evangelism, and that should be taken advantage of in Christian ministries that are sound, responsible, and well-credentialed should be supported in their efforts to evangelize in India. But a very dangerous thing is happening, and that is legislation introduced by the National Commission for Scheduled Castes and Tribes is going through the Indian Parliament right now and has very good chance of passing, which would make a new law requiring anyone wishing to change his or her religion to have a secondary education, that is, at least high school graduation, and receive written permission from a local official designated for that purpose. Because the untouchables, or the casteless ones, the Dalits, are in the lower classes, because they have less opportunity for education and for advancement, and they're in the lower economic reaches of the society, the vast majority of them are illiterate and dwell in rural areas. This means if this legislation passed, it will be almost impossible for them to change their religions. Now, those who are advocating this legislation say that it will stop the rise of cults in India and stop people from being forcibly converted, especially they're thinking about from Hinduism to Islam or just something like that. But those who reject the legislation or are speaking out against it say really what it's doing is it's going to make it practically illegal for anyone who is coming from a Hindu background to become a Christian.
And why would this law... I know they don't want to see people forcibly converted, and no one would, but what's in the interest of the whole system that is Hinduism as a culture and religion, especially in India, that would make this law so popular, that would essentially make it impossible for people to convert out?
Well, what's interesting is that India, especially after it became an independent nation in the early 1950s, is over 95% of it is Hindu. There was a larger Muslim population before it became an independent state, especially in northern India, in the east and the west. But with that separation into what was East Pakistan, now known as Bangladesh, and West Pakistan, most of the Muslims left India and went to those states, and most of the Hindus who were in those states came into the major subcontinent of India. So Hinduism is by far the prevalent religion, prevalent culture, and it really does control every area of Indian society. Hinduism is such an amalgamation of so many different things that one can be a polytheist, believing in many gods, a henotheist, believing in one main god and many lesser gods, even a pantheist, everything is divine and God is everything. And even some forms of Hinduism seem to be almost monotheistic, so that Hinduism thinks that it can provide a system of religion for everybody. Nobody needs to leave Hinduism to do anything else. But it is the cultural and the social effects of Hinduism over the ages, the strict demarcation into castes and classes, that actually controls the society. Even though that kind of discrimination is illegal, it still controls every area of society. People like the status quo. They don't want to see it change.
Finally, Gretchen, the last thing that I wanted to cover with you in our conversation is the recent death of Kenneth Hagin Sr., the so-called father, or sometimes called the grandfather, of the Word Faith movement. Give us a brief obituary and his place in this thing called Word Faith.
Yeah, Kenneth Hagin spent more than 50 years promoting his own brand of Christianity, which had to do with the idea that God speaks specially and personally, especially to Christian leaders, and gives them a word of God that has the same status and, in a personal sense, even greater status than the written word of God in your personal life. He's known as the source of some of the most prominent teachings in the Word Faith movement, including that Christ's death on the cross guarantees us physical healing, that when Christ says that we will prosper as Christians, he's not talking about spiritual prosperity but about material prosperity. The operation of the charismatic gifts in the everyday Christian's life on an everyday basis, all of those kinds of things can be traced to the teachings of Kenneth Hagin. He was born in 1917 and died at age 86 last September. his organization, he actually has several organizations, including a publication arm and training schools and radio and television ministry, have been led for the last 10 or 15 years by his son, Kenneth Hagin Jr., and that will continue.
And in the form of other teachers who are the, at least the theological progeny of Kenneth Hagin, the teaching of word, faith, that error that we discuss so often here on Issues, etc., is still alive and well?
Yes, some of the most popular proponents of the teachings that were characteristic of Kenneth Hagin's ministry are Paul and Jan Crouch, the leaders of Trinity Broadcasting Network, Kenneth Copeland, Marilyn Hickey, Jerry Savelle, and Benny Hinn.
Gretchen Pasentino, thank you very much for sticking with us a few minutes after the break and for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
Gretchen Pasentino is co-founder of Answers in Action, based in Costa Mesa, California. She's news editor for the Christian Research Journal. If you'd like to receive the Christian Research Journal, here's their toll-free number, 1-800-2-JOURNAL. That's 1-800-2-JOURNAL. Now, you can also visit the website for Answers in Action by going to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. There's a link there called Links with Regular Guests. Click on that. You'll find a direct link to Gretchen Pasentino and Answers in Action. For the remainder of this program, Wesley Smith joins us. Since we've come to a new year, halfway through this first month, Wesley Smith is going to bring us another update on Terry Schindler Schiavo. We'll also talk about the state of euthanasia in Europe and a new law on stem cell research in New Jersey. Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Give us an update on the Terry Schindler Schiavo case in Florida.
Well, as I write in this week's Weekly Standard, it is the calm before the storm. Terry is currently being nourished. Her feeding tube is in. She is, comfortable. But there is bad news. You know, she just celebrated her 40th birthday in December. And a lot of people went to her hospice and celebrated, put up birthday cards, which were quickly taken down at the insistence of Michael Schiavo, of course. But there are an awful lot of very powerful people in this culture who do not want her to see age 41, and they are determined to see her dead this year. And I'm very worried about that, because it's very clear that the judge who will determine the constitutionality of Terry's law in Florida, it seems real clear he's going to find Terry's law unconstitutional, because he said so. He said that the law is presumptively unconstitutional before Jeb Bush, who was sued by Michael Schiavo with the help of the ACLU, had even sent his pleadings to the court. Now, most of the time, if you attack a law, the law is presumed constitutional, and then you have to demonstrate why it isn't. In this case, that judge said it is presumably unconstitutional, and yet the Court of Appeals basically said that that didn't mean he had to disqualify himself for bias, which I think is ridiculous, considering there's at least a very strong appearance of bias. So I feel that the law is going to probably fall, and what happens after that is difficult, but we both know that Judge George Greer of the Sixth Judicial Circuit will order her feeding tube pulled a third time.
One of the most telling quotes that you have in your article, Beyond Terry's Law, What We Can Learn from the Schiavo Case, from the Weekly Standard, is a quote from Pat Anderson, an attorney for the Schindlers, the parents here.
Right.
He says, "I have never seen anything like the Terry Schiavo litigation. I call it the rule of Terry's case. If following a legal procedure will likely result in Terry dying, it will be adhered to. But if a procedure could make that outcome more difficult to attain, it will not be followed. It's the most frustrating experience of my legal career."
Yeah, and I think she's got good grounds for saying that, just as another couple of examples, one of which I write about in this and one which space did not permit me to write about. The one that I didn't write about is that a governor is supposed to be sued under Florida law in Tallahassee, and that would prevent the governor from having to defend laws and himself, you know, all over the state of Florida. In this situation, the attack on Terry's Law was filed in the Sixth Judicial Circuit, where it is mired. I call it an audio looping tape. You know, Michael Schiavo and George Filos' lawyers say that, oh, all kinds of judges have looked at this. This case cannot get out of the Sixth Judicial Circuit and the Second District Court of Appeal. So it keeps going to the same judges, back up and down, the same judges keep reviewing it instead of a fresh view and a fresh face. Well, when the governor attacked the filing, saying, wait a second, you sued me in the wrong jurisdiction, Judge Baird, who is the judge in charge of looking at Terry's Law, said, tough. I'm not going to dismiss the case. I'm keeping it. And, in fact, he just got transferred to a criminal court where usually, you know, when you move out of the court that he was in to a criminal court, you would give up those case files. But he kept specifically the Terry's Law case.
Wesley, what can and what should we learn from the Schiavo case?
I think what we can certainly learn is that there is the Right to Die movement, if you will, has created a terribly dangerous cultural atmosphere for people with significant cognitive incapacities and people who are elderly. Instead of giving the benefit of the doubt in questionable cases to life anymore, increasingly we give them to death. I've even been on shows where people have called the parents of Terry Schiavo evil, call-in shows, because they're trying to save their daughter from an agonizing 10 to 14-day dehydration. It's a terrible situation where the equality and sanctity of human life has been undermined significantly, and if you are somebody deemed to have a, quote, life not worth living, your lives are at real risk, not only in things such as this dehydration case, but as we've talked about in the past, futile care theory, where doctors presume the right to say no to wanted life-sustaining treatment if they don't think that the quality of the patient's life is worth living, and those protocols are being put in place in hospitals all across this country.
In a nutshell, Wesley, as an observer of this, I've talked with people about it, and most of them say, yeah, that Schiavo case, kind of like the Quinlan case, kind of like the other case, kind of like the other case, they lump them all together, and they say, well, someone's going to hash this out sooner or later. What about Terry's case is unique among all the others that are often discussed?
Well, first off, it's not like the Kiernan and Quinlan case, because we're dealing with a feeding tube, not a respirator, and I think that there is a huge moral difference between a feeding tube and a respirator. One causes much more significant bodily intrusion. The other is just providing food and water because somebody can't swallow. Moreover, excuse me, Todd, if you take away, like, Karen Ann Quinlan's respirator, you might expect her to die, but that doesn't mean she will. In fact, Karen Ann Quinlan lived for 10 years after her respirator was removed. And you take away somebody's ability to eat and drink, and they're going to die, if it's you or me or Terry Schiavo. Moreover, there is credible medical evidence in this case that if Terry was given therapy and rehabilitation, which he has been denied according to the medical record since about 1991, that she might even be able to be weaned off that feeding tube. But the courts are not even permitting that to be done. Therefore, not only is she being denied food and water Michael Schiavo prevails, but the opportunity to get off the medical treatment, as it's known, of tube feeding. It's an astonishing bum's rush, in my view, to death, based solely on the fact that she has a profound cognitive disability. If you did this to a horse, if you took away the food and water from a horse, you would go to jail. But you do it to somebody like Terry Schiavo because they have a feeding tube and they have a profound cognitive disability. It's just medical ethics.
Jumping to Great Britain, the news headline from today's paper, Britain's Dr. Death is found hanging in cell. Tell us about Dr. Harold Shipman.
Well, Dr. Shipman, over many, many years, killed scores of people, I think over 200 people, and people didn't know he was a serial killer. He was a general practitioner, and it shows you the amazing vulnerability we have when we go to doctors. Now, of course, doctors are not Shipman. Shipman was a monster. But if you do away with Hippocratic medicine, if you do away with do-no-harm values and the sanctity of life as a doctor, then people who are vulnerable, who are dependent on your good faith, can be very, very exposed to acute danger. And so while Shipman is certainly not typical, he's just a monster who happened to be a doctor and used that position to hide his nefarious conduct, I do think it is a warning bell that there are doctors out there and nurses, who will become so-called angels of death. There's a nurse that's been accused, I believe it's in Switzerland, of killing 24 patients. Doctors in the Netherlands kill patients who haven't asked to be euthanized all the time, and nothing is ever done about it, even though it's technically murder. Because, in fact, when you try to do, when people speak out against it, doctors rally around the offending doctor, saying to do otherwise would be to endanger the euthanasia law over there. So Shipman is an extreme case, but it shows you the danger of doing away with do no harm, Hippocratic values, and sanctity of life ethics.
It seems as though that very group of ethics is not only been done away with, but is a very, very distant, if at all, a faint memory. In the Netherlands, you've written about that recently, about euthanasia in Europe. Tell us about it.
Well, it's all but totally collapsed because Dutch in the Netherlands and now in Belgium, which has also legalized euthanasia, Dutch doctors, for example, have gone since 1973, when they first were allowed to start killing patients, have gone from killing terminally ill patients who ask for it to chronically ill to disabled patients who ask for it to people who aren't even sick who ask for it. In the Netherlands now, if you're depressed and not ill, you can still get assisted suicide. Babies are born with birth defects and disabilities are killed in their cribs in the Netherlands legally. This is eugenic infanticide. It is the very acts that German doctors did in World War II that for which they received a universal condemnation, and some were even hanged. And as I said, Dutch doctors kill about 1,000 patients a year who have not asked to be killed because they think it's the right thing to do. Because in the Netherlands, they've turned killing from something bad to something good. And therefore, the guidelines that are supposed to protect against abuse, instead of being viewed as protections, are seen as obstacles to the good of killing. And in the Netherlands, the very first euthanasia last year violated the guidelines, and now they're talking about reducing the age of consent to minorities, meaning people under the age of consent, under 18. The Netherlands right now at 16, and some there have advocated that it be reduced to 12, age 12, to be euthanized without parental consent.
And yet, Wesley, we're told by euthanasia advocates here and elsewhere as well that it's just a matter of having the right protocol. There won't be abuse as long as we have guidelines and protocols in place.
Well, you know, none are so blind as they who refuse to see. They have an ideological commitment to killing as an answer to human suffering and as an ability to somehow control death. And no facts are going to interfere with that ideology. And you can first they'll deny what goes on in the Netherlands, then when you prove it, they'll say, well, that's not the United States. Well, in the Netherlands, they don't have the financial pressures on healthcare that we do. It would be worse here, and many euthanasia advocates in the Netherlands say it would be a disaster to try it here in the United States.
Wesley, finally, how should we see the news that comes out of New Jersey here in the United States most recently about a law that allows stem cell research, apparently unbridled stem cell research, under the name of Moving Forward the Frontiers of Science? It got the signature of Governor James McCreevy very recently. How should we see that?
Well, first off, as you've just described it, is a falsehood, because what it really promotes is human cloning. Embryonic stem cell research is legal in this country. It was never needed to be legalized in New Jersey. The issue that President Bush dealt with in the first 6 months of his presidency had to do with federal funding, not legality. But what is really monstrous about the New Jersey law, now law, is that it specifically legalizes human cloning. It does not prevent human cloned embryos from being implanted in women's wombs, and it allows gestation through the ninth month. Therefore, it would permit human cloned fetal vivisection. The only time a woman and a doctor could become a criminal under the cloning law of New Jersey is if the cloned fetus was actually born into a baby and became a born new human individual, a human baby. At that point, they would be felons. So, in essence, the cloning bill of New Jersey requires abortion to prevent the woman from becoming a criminal if the fetus and embryo were cloned as opposed to naturally created. Now, the technology does not yet allow these kinds of experiments, But it's very clear that this is the desire of the biotech industry, not just to clone embryos to get their stem cells when they're like 1 week in development, but also to do experiment on fetuses. Otherwise, you wouldn't need this law. And this identical law has been proposed in the state of Texas. So it's not an accident. This is what biotech wants, an unlimited license to create human clones and engage in almost unfettered experimentation upon them.
And over the weekend, Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean, in criticizing President Bush's decision that you just mentioned before to limit funding, federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, said that, and he told the town hall meeting Friday, that if elected president, he would allow stem cell research. He looks forward to it, curing people like his nephew who has diabetes.
Well, you know, we've already cured diabetes in mice with adult stem cells. So Howard Dean is behind the science, but Howard Dean is the culture of death candidate. He supports partial birth abortion. He supports active euthanasia. He told that to a Oregon public radio show. He supports human cloning. He supports embryonic stem cell research, and he believes that Terri Schiavo should die.
So what would we look forward to? I mean, if I'm looking ahead 10 months...
If Howard Dean is elected president, the culture of death will have a field day, is all I can say, because he does not see any moral problems with any of the issues I've just addressed.
Wesley Smith, thank you for keeping on top of these issues for us and for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate it.
Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. You can read several columns written by Wesley on his website, wesleyjsmith.com, wesleyjsmith, all one word, .com. Now, when we come back from this break, it's the third hour of Issues Etc., but also it's your opportunity here the first time for a while, live since last Friday, to do a little open lines, a little questioning, a little commenting, anything you want to talk about for the entire remaining hour of Issues Etc. But I also have some things to bring to you as well. You might want to react to them. Have you heard this? It was mentioned earlier by Pastor Dick Fisher in our conversation. George Barna, researcher for All Things Christian, has discovered, in the midst of examining the disparity between the worldviews of many American Christians and the worldview put forth by the Bible, he has discovered an even more shocking disparity. And that is, those who know better, or I guess I should say, should know better, should believe better and should teach better, the pastors of American Protestantism, less than half, slightly less than half of them, hold to even the most basic outline of what could be called a biblical worldview. I spent the whole weekend talking to pastors about the worldviews out there and the biblical worldview that they and their people should hold. When we come back, we're going to find out what George Barna discovered about what worldview your pastor might have. Stay with us. It's Open Lines when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.